This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, with The Week magazine of February 21st. Trump allies rage at courts amid judicial pushback. Legal experts warned that America was headed toward a constitutional crisis this week as the Trump administration failed to comply with at least two court judgments, and Vice President J.D. Vance argued that judges have no authority to restrain executive power. President Trump's flurry of sweeping executive orders has led state attorneys general, labor unions, and other groups to file more than 50 lawsuits, yielding numerous judgments against the administration. Judges have issued temporary blocks on a buoyant program for federal workers, the forced leave of thousands of USAID employees, access to government payment systems by members of Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, and an executive order to end birthright citizenship. But a federal judge said that the administration was openly defying his clear and unambiguous orders to unfreeze billions of dollars in federal assistance, and USAID workers filed a complaint that they had not been reinstated as ordered. White House spokesman Harrison Fields said the administration's actions have all been completely lawful. Musk called for the impeachment of Manhattan-based U.S. District Judge Paul A. Engelmayer, who barred DOGE staffers from accessing sensitive Treasury records and posted on X that radical left activists posing as judges are staging a coup. Vance wrote on X that judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. Meanwhile, Trump accused courts of trying to stop us from looking for corruption, adding, "Maybe we have to look at the judges." Amid the legal wrangling, the administration ramped up its offensive against the federal bureaucracy. It shuttered the Office of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and sidelined its staff and cut $900 million from a Department of Education agency that tracks student progress and educational best practices. Trump signed an executive order directing agency officials to draft plans for large-scale staff reductions and mandating that future hires be made in conjunction with a DOGE team lead. "The goal is to restore democracy," said Musk at an Oval Office signing. "If the bureaucracy's in charge, then what meaning does democracy actually have?" "Well, that was fast," said the Wall Street Journal. "Just 3 weeks into the Trump presidency, and the doomsayers who warned that he'd be a dictator now say a constitutional crisis has arrived." Ignore them. Most of Trump's actions rest on strong legal ground. With others, he is testing legal boundaries, aiming to tee up Supreme Court rulings he hopes will go his way. That's no crisis. It's just what President Joe Biden did when he exceeded his power by canceling student loans and banning evictions. But unlike Biden, who found new ways to push through loan write-offs, Trump has said he will always abide by the courts. "Believe that at America's peril," said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. "Trump is a constitutional bulldozer who's running roughshod over a compliant Congress. That leaves the courts as the only effective backstop blocking Trump's plainly unconstitutional moves. But the court's power is reliant on universal respect for judicial review, and Trump, Musk, and Vance are signaling they don't intend to play by the rules." "It's not hyperbole anymore," said Josh Marshall in Talking Points memo. "Musk is in charge of the U.S. government. He loomed over his boss this week as Trump signed an order putting DOGE commissars in charge of personnel decisions at every federal agency, effectively giving Musk authority over the entire structure of the U.S. government." "Three cheers for that," said Nicole Russell in USA Today. "It's thrilling to see an administration finally targeting federal waste and fraud. Democrats are howling about overreach, but this is exactly what Americans voted for." "It's also blatantly illegal," said former White House counsel Alan Charles Raoul in the Washington Post. "The Constitution is clear. Agencies and programs created by statute can't be killed or transformed without Congress's approval. The radical overhaul underway isn't just testing boundaries, it's shattering the fundamental checks and balances of our constitutional order. If Congress won't stop it, the Supreme Court must. They won't if Vance has any say, said Ian Ward in Politico. Over the years, he's made repeated claims for executive supremacy and, said a reelected Trump, should defy judges who stand in his way. If the Supreme Court were to block a government overhaul, he said in 2021, Trump should stand before the country like President Andrew Jackson did and say, the Chief Justice has made his ruling. Now let him enforce it. It's possible cooler heads will prevail, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. But with Trump's every step toward authoritarianism meeting GOP acquiescence, it'd be no surprise to see him take the next one. We may be sleepwalking into a constitutional crisis. We're already there, said Amber Phillips in The Washington Post. So say experts who've watched in horror as Trump has fired watchdogs, steamrolled Congress, and otherwise cast off any restraint. There are few guardrails left, and as bad as things are now, a move to buck court orders would be an alarming escalation. We're looking into an abyss where the premise of the rule of law may be rejected, said Ben Raderstorff of the nonpartisan Protect Democracy group. That's where things get really scary. Gabbard takes helm of U.S. spy agencies. The Senate confirmed Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence last week, despite warnings from 100 former national security officers that she was unfit for the office, a vote that indicates that the rest of President Trump's cabinet nominees are also likely to be confirmed. Gabbard, an Iraq War veteran and former Democratic Congresswoman for Hawaii, has never held an intelligence position. During her confirmation hearings, Republican and Democratic senators alike criticized her previous support for National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden, her 2017 meetings with then-Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, and her history of repeating Russian lies, such as that the U.S. had funded biological weapons programs in Ukraine. Still, lawmakers voted 52-48 to put her in charge of guiding America's 18 intelligence agencies. The only Republican no vote came from Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who said Gabbard was disqualified by her history of alarming lapses in judgment. The Senate also advanced the nomination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health and Human Services and was expected to confirm him as the week went to press. Kash Patel, also likely to be advanced as FBI director, could get a Senate vote next week. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, last week accused Patel of lying to senators under oath, saying that while Patel had assured them that he was not aware of Trump's plans to fire FBI agents involved in the January 6th investigation, new evidence shows he has in fact helped orchestrate that purge. But Republicans said they were confident that both Kennedy and Patel would get the necessary votes. My goal is to make sure every one of President Trump's nominees got confirmed, said Senator John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming, urging his colleagues to move ahead with urgency. How quickly things can change in politics, said Max Cohen and John Bresnahan in Punch Bowl News. Mere weeks ago, these nominees faced a tidal wave of bad press and Democratic attacks. Gabbard left senators at her hearing aghast by failing to condemn Snowden, who leaked hundreds of thousands of secret U.S. documents and defected to Moscow. During Kennedy's hearing, he was called a conspiracy theorist, and Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, a doctor, delivered a point-by-point evisceration of his anti-vaxxer views. But then Vice President J.D. Vance got to work on the holdouts, and the online MAGA army harassed them. Eventually, their initial shock gave way to a begrudging acceptance. Trump will now get his daily intelligence briefings from a profile peddler of Russian propaganda, said Richard Hall and Andrew Feinberg in The Independent of the UK. Gabbard has backed Moscow and railed against the U.S. whenever the two countries' interests collided. When Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, she blamed not Vladimir Putin, but NATO. Russia is so delighted with her, its state media called her a superwoman. Yet, Republicans brushed all that aside to put her in charge of American intelligence. Similarly, few Republican senators really think Kennedy is an appropriate person to run federal health agencies, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. But they accept him as a coalition choice. Because he left the Democratic Party, endorsed Trump, and brought some of his voters with him, including voters who are skeptical of big pharma and want to see action on chronic disease, he is being rewarded with a cabinet post, no matter how ill-suited for the job. If the Senate is going to reject a Trump nominee, said the Washington Post in an editorial, let it be Patel. A Trump sycophant, he appears eager to seek retribution against the president's perceived enemies, including former administration officials, journalists, FBI agents, and former FBI Director Christopher A. Wray. Patel has made so many false and misleading claims that even Trump's former Attorney General Bill Barr says he's unfit. Lives are on the line here, said James D. Zirin in The Hill. With Kennedy in charge of health, science will be sidelined, and children could die without access to safe and effective vaccines. Gabbard, as DNI, won't be trusted by our allies, who may decline to share intelligence that could prevent the next terrorist attack. And Patel seems far more interested in executing Trump's revenge mission than in ensuring domestic safety. These three are unqualified, unprincipled, and untethered. This is really terrifying. USAID, the end of American soft power? And just like that, the world's greatest humanitarian country has become one of its least, said Mona Charon in The Bulwark. At the behest of President Trump, Elon Musk, the world's richest man and head of Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, entered the headquarters of the U.S. Agency for International Development earlier this month and began, in his own gleeful words, feeding USAID into the wood chipper. In a matter of days, Musk's Doge gang had taken down USAID's website, put nearly all the agency's 10,000 workers on leave, and halted the flow of aid to the most vulnerable people on Earth. No one denies there's wasteful spending in government, said Bill Press in The Hill, but USAID delivered taxpayers more bang for our buck than any other government program. It has saved millions of lives at a cost of about $40 billion a year, less than 1% of the federal budget. USAID funds HIV/AIDS treatments in Africa, landmine clearance in Cambodia, emergency housing in Ukraine, and much more. Russia and China will quickly fill the soft power vacuum left by the agency's demise, making this one of the most short-sighted and stupid decisions by any modern president. Gutting USAID might sound heinous, said Nicole Russell in USA Today, but it must be done. Voters elected Trump to put America first. With U.S. families struggling with inflation and the federal deficit hitting a whopping $1.8 trillion last year, it's hard to justify USAID spending $53 million in climate-resilient activities in developing world cities. Then there's the $400 million digital technology project for LGBTQ people in Africa, said National Review in an editorial. But the problem isn't just a handful of programs. It's that USAID has strayed from its founding mission of using aid to promote capitalism and political liberty and has become focused on the twin obsessions of climate change and DEI. Trump has given Secretary of State Marco Rubio responsibility for the agency. Now he must turn it into an international development assistance system that truly advances America's interests. Trump may have miscalculated, said Nick Catoggio in the Dispatch. Yes, Americans are opposed to foreign aid in principle, 69% said we spend too much in a 2023 poll, but they'll get queasy when they see the human toll of this pullback. Treatment for HIV-positive infants in Uganda has been halted. Medical trial participants in South Africa have been abandoned with experimental devices still in their bodies, and Sudanese children are being left to starve. About $2 billion worth of American food aid is grown here in the U.S., said Daniel Wu in the Washington Post. Now, hundreds of thousands of tons of that food is rotting in warehouses, and U.S. farmers who once supplied the government are stuck in limbo. All true, said Rui Teixeira in the Free Press, but it's political suicide for Democrats to rush to USAID's defense. The legality of DOJ's work is at best unclear. It's Congress's job, not the president's, to regulate agencies and authorize spending. While the courts untangle the mess, Democrats should keep their powder dry, not confirm their reputation as foreign coddling champions of bureaucracy. Democrats shouldn't defend USAID as an institution, said Jonathan V. Last in the Bulwark, but they should flood social media with the faces and stories of the actual people who are going to die because a president entrusted their fates to a ketamine-addled billionaire and his menagerie of 20-year-old incels. Only in America. A blind man from Indiana is questioning the state's decision to issue him a concealed carry gun permit. Terry Sutherland admits he was trying to prove a point when he walked, assisted by a sight stick, into state offices in Indianapolis and applied for a gun permit. But he says, "It shocked me more than I expected when officials approved his application, no questions asked. I thought at the last second somebody would go, 'Wait a minute,'" said Sutherland. The National Maritime Museum of the Gulf of Mexico in Mobile, Alabama, is considering its options in the wake of President Trump's executive order renaming that body of water the Gulf of America. Museum Director Karen Poth said her institution had only just completed a $100,000 rebranding. It was known as Gulf Quest Maritime Museum until last year, and that to honor Trump's wishes would involve a complete redo and be very, very expensive. It was a good week for self-deportation after new data revealed that a record number of Americans applied for Irish citizenship and passports following Donald Trump's election win. Eric Clayton, an applicant in New Hampshire, said she figured a second passport would be smart to have just in case. It was a good week for surprise guests after a woman vacationing at a beachfront hotel in the Netherlands returned to her room to find a gray ocean seal sleeping on the floor. At first, the seal was completely relaxed, said wildlife rescue workers, but it became quite grumpy once awoken. It was a good week for tradition after the Church of England's ruling body ruled that, no, the church will not offer wheat-free wafers and non-alcoholic wine as part of its Eucharist ritual. Bishop of Lichfield Michael Ipgrave assured non-drinking, glutinous-stewing believers that they can still be partakers by faith of the body and blood of Christ. It was a bad week for literalism after a doctor in Italy was placed under investigation for using hospital equipment to give his injured cat a CAT scan before successfully operating on the feline. She was between life and death, an unapologetic Gianluca Fanelli said of his pet, Athena. I knew I could only save her with a quick intervention. It was a bad week for stiff upper lips after England's Earl of Yarmouth sued his parents for the trauma of having not inherited the family's 6,000-acre, $105 million estate on his 30th birthday. William Seymour said the news upended his life and forced him to seek professional help and counseling. It was a bad week for curiosity after Sri Lankan officials blamed a nationwide power cut on a macaque who came into contact with our grid transformer at a power station south of Colombo. Electricity was soon restored to Sri Lanka's 22 million residents. There's no word on the monkey's condition. Churchill County, Nevada, new bird flu strain. Federal health officials reported last week that a Nevada dairy worker has contracted a new strain of bird flu from a cow, the first recorded instance of cow-to-human transmission of the genotype. The strain, called D1.1, emerged in the U.S. among wild birds in September and in December killed a 65-year-old Louisiana man who contracted it from birds. It was detected in cows for the first time ever last month among four dairy cattle herds in Nevada. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said the risk to the public remains low. Only 15 people in the U.S. have contracted D1.1, but experts fear the strain's genetic mutations may allow for more efficient virus replication in mammals. It very well can be that that particular genotype of virus is more likely to adapt to human cells, said Dr. Scott Hensley, a microbiologist at the University of Pennsylvania. We just don't know yet. New York City, FEMA firings. The Trump administration last week fired four Federal Emergency Management Agency employees after Elon Musk claimed the agency misused millions meant for disaster relief. Musk wrote on social media that FEMA spent $59 million designated for disaster relief on high-end hotels for migrants in New York City. Local officials said that Congress allotted the federal funds to house migrants last year and that the money did not go to luxury rooms. The allocation of $650 million, including $237 million for New York City, was administered by FEMA but came out of the Customs and Border Protection budget and was not meant for disaster relief. Still, FEMA announced it had suspended payments under the program, though most have already been dispersed. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees FEMA, said staffers, including FEMA's chief financial officer, were fired for unilaterally making egregious payments. Fort Bragg, North Carolina, renamed again. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth last week ordered the Army base Fort Liberty to revert to its original name, Fort Bragg, which honored slave-owning Confederate War General Braxton Bragg. Fort Bragg became Fort Liberty in 2023, one of nine bases that got new names in an effort to rid U.S. monuments and bases of Confederate figures. The Pentagon said the base's new name honors a different Bragg, Roland Bragg, a soldier who fought in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. Hegseth rolled back other Biden-era initiatives last week prohibiting the armed services from recruiting transgender people and pausing gender dysphoria treatment for service members. Under his direction to eliminate DEI programs, the West Point Military Academy disbanded a dozen affinity groups such as Society of Women Engineers and the Latin Cultural Club. New York City, friend of Trump. The Justice Department last week ordered prosecutors to drop federal charges against Eric Adams, the embattled New York mayor who has pulled himself into President Trump's orbit. The Democrat faced five criminal counts, including bribery. Acting U.S. Deputy Attorney General Emil Bove, himself a former federal prosecutor in New York, said Adams's indictment was inhibiting the mayor's ability to aid Trump's immigration crackdown, but admitted the department hadn't assessed the strength of the prosecution's case. Prosecutors accused Adams of pressuring the fire department to quickly approve a new Turkish consulate, accepting over $100,000 in plane tickets and upgrades, and receiving illegal foreign campaign contributions. Many New Yorkers still question my character, Adams said, but now we can put this cruel episode behind us. Trump last week also pardoned former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, whose 14-year corruption sentence Trump commuted in 2020. The Democrats supported Trump in 2020 and 2024. Brussels, no NATO for Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said last week that the U.S. does not support Ukraine joining NATO and would no longer prioritize Ukraine's defense against Russia. The United States does not believe that NATO membership for Ukraine is a realistic outcome of a negotiated settlement, Hegseth said at a Brussels meeting of Ukraine's allies. He added that it was unrealistic to expect that Ukraine could regain all its territory, particularly Crimea, which Russia forcibly annexed in 2014. Meanwhile, President Trump said last week that he and Russian President Vladimir Putin had spoken by phone and agreed to start negotiations immediately to end the war. But European officials said Hegseth has effectively ceded Ukraine's biggest bargaining chips to Russia in advance. Guatemala City, cult accused. Guatemalan authorities last week charged members of the extremist Jewish Lev Tahor sect with human trafficking and child abuse, saying the sect was marrying underage girls to adult men. Lev Tahor, a fringe ultra-Orthodox group that Israel has labeled a cult, has moved from country to country as various governments crack down on its practices. It has been based in Guatemala for about a decade, but last month police raided its compound, taking away 160 children and 40 women. Attorney General Julio Saavedra said the children had been indoctrinated to believe that government authorities will harm them, and they were refusing food and wouldn't give their names. They have received clear instructions not to cooperate in any way, he said. Quito, Ecuador, leftist forces runoff. Center-right President Daniel Noboa narrowly failed to win re-election in a first round of voting last week and will face an April runoff against leftist Luisa Gonzalez, the same candidate he defeated when he was first elected in 2023. Noboa, 37, the son of a banana tycoon, has focused his presidency on a crackdown on violent gangs that has brought down Ecuador's murder rate somewhat, although it remains one of the highest in the world. Gonzalez, a protege of former President Rafael Correa, said she would be tough on crime too, but would also boost social spending and concentrate on diversifying the economy. Noboa represents fear, she said. We represent hope. Moscow, American released. Russia released American teacher and former diplomat Mark Fogel last week, nearly 4 years after arresting him on charges of possessing medical marijuana. President Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, billionaire real estate developer Steve Witkoff, negotiated Fogel's freedom in return for the release of Alexander Vinnik, a Russian convicted in the U.S. of operating a cryptocurrency exchange that helped cybercriminals launder money, and brought him home on his private jet. Witkoff was the first high-ranking U.S. official to visit Moscow since 2021, when then-CIA Director William J. Burns traveled there to warn Russia against invading Ukraine. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz called Fogel's release a show of good faith from the Russians. Beijing, staying single. The number of couples marrying in China plunged by 20.5% last year to the lowest level in four decades, according to data released last week. The drop came despite the government offering financial incentives and pushing propaganda exhorting young people to marry and have children. Marriages have been declining steadily for more than a decade, except for a brief rebound after COVID restrictions ended. The 6.1 million recorded in 2024 are half the 2013 peak. The trend has raised fears that China's population, which has decreased for three straight years, will also continue dropping, threatening growth in the world's second largest economy. If this keeps up, said the University of Wisconsin demographer Yi Fushan, China's ambitions will be ruined by its demographic Achilles heel. Jerusalem, hostages in bad shape. The shocking state of three hostages released by Hamas last week, who emerged frail and emaciated, has increased pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to bring home the rest as soon as possible. They look like Holocaust survivors, said Foreign Minister Gideon Sar. The three, Eli Sharabi, 52, Or Levy, 34, and Ohad Ben Ami, 56, who were captured during Hamas's 2023 attack on southern Israel, said that they were tortured frequently during their 16 months in captivity, including by being choked and gagged, hung upside down, and burned with hot pokers. Before their release, they were paraded on a stage and forced to recite words of thanks to their captors. So far, Hamas has released 16 of the 33 hostages it is to hand over under the first phase of the ceasefire deal the two sides reached last month, while Israel has released nearly 700 Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli government has also been allowing hundreds of aid trucks into Gaza daily, significantly increasing supplies of food, water, and medicine available in the Palestinian enclave. But the deal is threatening to collapse. Hamas said it would postpone the next release because Israel has failed to comply with other terms, such as allowing displaced Palestinians to go back to their ruined cities in northern Gaza. Hamas said Israel was targeting those returning with shelling and gunfire. Netanyahu said if the hostages don't come home on time, Israel would return to intense fighting in Gaza. Walter's marriage secret. At age 74, Harriet Walter is suddenly a hot commodity, said Janice Turner in the Times of the UK. Having spent decades as a largely unknown stage performer, the British actor became a breakout TV star in recent years, playing chilly, abrasive characters in hit shows such as Succession, Killing Eve, Ted Lasso, and The Crown. Walter is used to such late-in-life surprises. After her long-term partner died of lung cancer in 2004, she largely gave up on the idea of finding love again and threw herself back into work. But while appearing on Broadway in 2009, Walter found herself chatting every night to a castmate, American actor Guy Paul. It's very difficult to embark on a love affair in later life, she says. When you're young, that's what everything's aimed at. Music, culture, party culture, club culture. It's all about getting a partner. Whereas when you're older, it's much harder to see the signals. Eventually, Walter asked Paul out to the movies to see the Iraq War movie The Hurt Locker. Perfect date film, she laughs. They wed at age 60, both for the first time. Does she recommend late marriage? It's exactly when you want to be married. When you want to do all sorts of things and you've got a companion to travel with and hang out, and you don't have these idealized, impossible visions of how people should be. Why Ford still flies. Harrison Ford prefers the view from above, said John Jurgensen in the Wall Street Journal. The actor is a licensed pilot and describes flying as his second job. He's used his Bell 407 helicopter for search and rescue missions in Wyoming and his turboprop Cessna Caravan to drop doctors and medical supplies in Haiti after the country's 2010 earthquake. But Ford, 82, also flies for fun, regularly making solo runs between his Jackson Hole Ranch and the East Coast. You've got to stop every 2.5 hours to take a pee and stretch your legs, but you can do the trip at 500 feet without talking to anybody. The journey never gets old. You see the actual physical history of how places grew up, where people are living. Sometimes he offers to fly friends home from Los Angeles. They say, yeah, that'd be great. Then somehow they tell their wife and she says, he's an actor, right? And he adds, I crashed. That was in 2015 when the engine of his World War II-era open cockpit plane failed. He suffered serious injuries in an emergency landing, but it didn't dent his love of flying. Ford knows people might see him as just another rich guy with a fleet of expensive toys. Flying seems like it's something you put on, like a fur coat, but it's important to me as a person. Taylor Swift's Super Bowl Sunday soured long before her beau, Kansas City Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce, lost in a blowout to the Philadelphia Eagles. In the game's first quarter, Eagle fans booed loudly when Swift, a Pennsylvania-born former Eagles supporter, appeared on the Jumbotron at Caesars Superdome. Another high-profile attendee was delighted by the crowd's reaction in New Orleans. The only one that had a tougher night than the Kansas City Chiefs was Taylor Swift, President Trump wrote on social media. MAGA is very unforgiving. The president, 78, has long been fixated on Swift, 35. After she endorsed Kamala Harris in last year's presidential election, Trump said the pop superstar would probably pay a price for backing his opponent and posted online, "I hate Taylor Swift." Kanye West deactivated his X account last week after embarking on a days-long posting spree in which he spewed anti-Semitic hate and declared himself a Nazi. In a deluge of posts, the rapper told his 32.7 million X followers that "I love Hitler" called the Nazi dictator so fresh and said he would never apologize for my Jewish comments. West's X account was suspended after he made a string of anti-Semitic comments in 2022, but it was reinstated by the platform's owner, Elon Musk, in 2023. This time, Musk allowed West's account to remain active until he began sharing uncensored clips from pornographic movies. "You should not be seeing that anymore," Musk wrote on X. West eventually deactivated his account after sharing one final message. "I appreciate Elon for allowing me to vent," he wrote. "It's been very cathartic." Indian police pulled the plug on a surprise street performance by British songster Ed Sheeran last week. The four-time Grammy winner was busking on a busy sidewalk in Bengaluru, strumming his hit song Shape of You, when a uniformed officer yanked the cord for his microphone. Police said they needed to keep people moving in a busy area. "Even global stars must follow local rules," local politician P. Chekamuni Mohan wrote online. "No permit, no performance." Sheeran, who is on a 15-day tour of India, said he'd followed the law and that the performance wasn't as spontaneous as it seemed. "We had permission to busk," he wrote on Instagram. "It wasn't just us randomly turning up." Panama's troubled waters. President Trump has vowed to take back the U.S.-built Panama Canal. Is that in America's interest? How important is the canal to the U.S.? A former symbol of American imperialism, the 51-mile man-made channel linking the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans remains critical to the U.S.'s economy and security. The canal today handles about 5% of the world's seaborne trade and 40% of all U.S. container traffic. An annual $270 billion in cargo passes through it. Before the U.S.-built canal was completed in 1914, a ship sailing from New York to San Francisco had to go around the southern tip of South America, a dangerous journey that could take months. The canal reduced that trip to weeks. Today it takes 11 days, allowing the U.S. to flex its naval and commercial might around the world. The waterway linked America's growing Pacific power to more traditional Atlantic relationships, said Richard Feinberg, a professor of international political economy at the University of California, San Diego. President Trump now wants the U.S. to again control and operate the canal, just as it did for the waterway's first 85 years, saying the 1977 deal that ceded the canal to Panama was a foolish gift. How did the U.S. come to build the canal? That tale begins in 1903 when Panama, then part of Colombia, declared its independence. It got an assist from President Theodore Roosevelt, who recognized the breakaway nation and sent U.S. warships to protect it. In return, Roosevelt secured a treaty that for $10 million gave the U.S. the right to build the waterway, plus control of a canal zone extending 5 miles on either side. Cutting a path through Panama's mountains, swamps, and dense jungle was a staggering effort that took 10 years and cost the lives of more than 5,600 workers, most of them Afro-Caribbean. The canal was regarded as a wonder of engineering when it opened, but in the following decades, local resentment grew over the 553-square-mile canal zone, which was off-limits to ordinary Panamanians. This was the most valuable piece of land in the country, said Oviedo Diaz Espino, an expert on the canal's history, and it was being exploited by somebody else. Tensions hit a boil in January 1964 when anti-U.S. rioting broke out. 21 Panamanians and 4 U.S. soldiers were killed. The U.S. and Panama began negotiations on the canal's ownership, talks that concluded with the 1977 signing of 2 treaties by President Jimmy Carter. What was agreed? One treaty stated that the U.S. would gradually transfer canal ownership to Panama, with the handover being completed on December 31, 1999. The other mandated that Panama would charge just, reasonable, and equitable canal transit fees and allow the U.S. military to combat any threat to its neutral operation. The treaties held even after President George H.W. Bush sent U.S. troops into Panama in 1989 to remove strongman leader General Manuel Noriega. But Trump now claims Panama has violated the neutrality treaty. He says it is overcharging U.S. ships, even though all ships are charged by a set formula based on size, cargo, and other factors. In his inaugural address, he claimed that China is operating the canal, and so we're taking it back. He has since refused to rule out a military intervention. Are the Chinese running the canal? Panamanian President José Raúl Mulino calls the claim nonsense, noting there is not a single Chinese soldier in the canal, for the love of God. Still, concern is rising in Washington about Beijing's growing presence in the region. In 2017, Panama became the first Latin American nation to join China's Belt and Road Initiative. China is now backing infrastructure projects there, including a canal bridge, a railway line, and a cruise ship terminal. The primary concern, though, is the Hong Kong-based companies that operate 2 of 5 ports adjacent to the canal, one on each end. Beijing could use those facilities to gather data on canal traffic or to host Chinese military assets. A foreign power today possesses, through their companies, which we know are not independent, the ability to turn the canal into a choke point, said Secretary of State Marco Rubio. How has Panama responded to Trump's threats? Mulino insists a return of the waterway is out of the question. Every square meter of the Panama Canal and its adjacent zone area belongs to Panama, he said. Trump's words have stirred outrage and anxiety among Panamanians. Hundreds protested Rubio's visit to Panama City this month, and some burned images of Rubio and Trump. But the tiny country, which has no army, could offer no meaningful resistance if Trump decided to use force to grab the canal. All he needs is to land 10,000 troops, and that's it, said Diaz Espino. Would Trump do that? Few experts expect Trump to try to seize the canal. More likely, he is angling for more favorable terms or U.S. investment opportunities. Fees have risen sharply in recent years, due in part to drought conditions that have lowered the canal's capacity. But it's not clear what any concessions might look like. Mulino announced last week that his country will leave the Belt and Road Initiative, and the State Department claimed Panama would allow U.S. Navy ships to pass through for free, a claim Mulino blasted as false, and Rubio quickly walked back. It hints at one possible concession, but the $13 million the Defense Department pays in fees is dust compared with its $850 billion budget, said Trump's former Panama Ambassador John Feely. By offering the U.S. favorable terms, Panama would also violate the 1977 treaties, which guarantee equal treatment for all canal users. And Trump's public stance remains that nothing short of full U.S. control will do. We're taking it back, he said, or something very powerful is going to happen. And in other news, NIH medical research on the chopping block. The Trump administration is feeding the National Institutes of Health into the wood chipper, said Zeynep Tufekci in the New York Times. The agency is the world's largest funder of biomedical research, awarding grants to more than 300,000 researchers at over 2,500 institutions, including the Mayo Clinic and MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas. Such grants have paved the way for new treatments for cancer and HIV, pioneering techniques like IVF and wonder drugs like Ozempic. But in the name of efficiency, the administration now wants to slash $4 billion from the NIH budget by capping the amount grant recipients receive for indirect costs, general costs like equipment and utility bills, at 15% of their total grant, down from an average of 27%. Under that new ratio, the University of Alabama at Birmingham's medical system, which employs 28,000 people, would lose $70 million a year. A federal judge has temporarily paused the cuts, but if they are allowed to go ahead, universities and academic hospitals will be forced to decide what projects to shut down and which researchers to lay off. This will make Americans sick again. The targets of this cut are bloated university bureaucracies, not critical science research, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner. Of the $35 billion in grants the NIH gave out in fiscal 2023, $9 billion went to overheads, with institutions like Harvard and Yale receiving indirect costs of more than 60%. That's why Trump's cost-cutter-in-chief, Elon Musk, rightly called the old system a ripoff. Under the new policy, NIH will be in line with respected private funders of research like Bill Gates's foundation, which caps overheads at 15%. Indirect costs in NIH grants are a perfectly reasonable target for reform, said Yuval Levin in the New Atlantic. But the current rates are mandated by a congressionally approved appropriations rider, so the administration's forced cuts are probably illegal. Once again, the Trump administration has decided to grandstand rather than govern. This anarchy is a feature, not a bug, for Trump and his minions, said Greg Gonsalves in The Nation. They know that even a brief pause in funding can be devastating because scientific research that relies on continuity, such as the monitoring of cell lines, is wiped out when the lights go off. But that's acceptable for this administration, which regards liberal-dominated universities as the enemy and cuts in life-saving NIH funding as another weapon to hurt higher education. All of this is going to have deadly and lasting consequences. Doge, Musk's young attack dogs. In a development that captures the unique insanity of the current political moment, a 19-year-old named Big Balls is now advising the State Department, said Lucas Ropek in Gizmodo. That's the online username of Edward Korestein, a Department of Government efficiency engineer recruited to help Elon Musk dismantle the federal government. In a twist seemingly straight out of South Park, he's reportedly been made a senior advisor at the State Department's Technology Bureau, which means someone barely out of high school now has a horrifying amount of access to government data and computer systems. Adding to the alarm, it was revealed last week that Korestein was fired from an internship at a cybersecurity firm in 2022 for leaking company secrets. He is just one of a team of young male engineers spearheading Musk's dizzying blitz on the federal bureaucracy, said Theodore Schlieffer in the New York Times. Across the government, techies in jeans and sneakers are sweeping into agency headquarters with black backpacks and a mandate to break the system. Big Balls isn't the only Doge hire drawing scrutiny, said Robert Tate in The Guardian. Marco Ellis, a 25-year-old who worked for Musk at SpaceX, resigned last week after a media report linked him to a social media account making numerous racist posts. I was racist before it was cool, he allegedly posted last July. Normalize Indian hate, read a September post. But Musk quickly vowed to rehire him, a decision supported by Vice President J.D. Vance, who called Ellis a kid whose life was being destroyed by agenda-driven journalists. Meanwhile, another Doge engineer, 25-year-old Gavin Kleger, was revealed to have boosted social media posts by outspoken white supremacist Nick Fuentes and self-declared misogynist Andrew Tate, who is under investigation in Romania for human trafficking, rape, and other charges. Kleger has since deleted the posts. Vance's defense of Ellis is absurd, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. The supposed kid is 25 and wrote his racist posts just last year. But his argument isn't supposed to make sense. Vance is asserting the Trump administration's freedom from the need to justify its actions according to traditional mores. Under the new standards, diversity is taboo and racism is not, and it's a-okay to give bomb-throwing youngsters a major role in restructuring the federal government. As the Trump administration is showing us daily, the old rules don't apply anymore. Brains brimming with plastic. Microplastics are accumulating in our brains and may affect our cognitive health. That's the alarming conclusion of a new study of 52 brain specimens from autopsies, about half from 2016 and half from 2024. Researchers found tiny fragments of plastic in every sample, but concentrations were about 50% higher in the more recent batch, some penetrating deep into the frontal cortex. Earlier samples, dating back to 1997, had the least plastic. Even more alarming, the brains of people who had dementia when they died exhibited 3 to 5 times more microplastics than normal brains, although causality there is uncertain since people with dementia already have weaker blood-brain barriers. Every time we scratch the surface, co-author Matthew Campen from the University of New Mexico tells the Washington Post, it uncovers a whole host of, oh, is this worse than we thought? Campen says the increase makes intuitive sense, given that global plastic production doubles every 10 to 15 years. He says more research into the issue is needed, particularly concerning the potential health risks, but that the ubiquity of microplastics makes that difficult. There are no control groups, he said. Everyone is exposed. Lung cancer in non-smokers. The proportion of non-smokers diagnosed with lung cancer is rising, a new study suggests. In the U.S., up to 20% of lung cancers now occur in people who've smoked fewer than 100 cigarettes in their lifetime. And worldwide, lung cancer is never smokers now ranks fifth in causes of cancer deaths. Researchers say one likely explanation is air pollution, which has been shown to increase the risk of adenocarcinoma, the type of lung cancer that makes up some 70% of such cases. But another is simply that there are fewer smokers than there used to be. With declines in smoking prevalence, as seen in the UK and US, the proportion of lung cancers diagnosed among those who have never smoked tends to increase, lead author Freddie Bray from the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, tells The Guardian of the UK. Whether the global proportion of adenocarcinomas attributable to ambient air pollution will increase depends on the relative success of future strategies to curtail tobacco use and air pollution worldwide. Our rat-infested future. As if intense hurricanes, scorching heat waves, and prolonged droughts weren't bad enough, climate change appears to be having another unwelcome effect, reports the Los Angeles Times. It is causing rat populations to explode. Researchers who analyzed sightings of the rodents found that numbers have increased over the past decade in 11 of 16 global cities studied. The worst increases were in the U.S., with rats up a terrifying 390% in Washington, D.C., and 162% in New York City. When the researchers looked at factors that might account for the differences, including population density and vegetation coverage, they found that the most important one was the city's average temperature. The more it rose, the more rats. That makes intuitive sense because cold weather is one of the few things that can slow down the rodent's breakneck reproductive cycle. Under good conditions, rats have a new litter every 3 to 4 weeks. As the world gets warmer, says lead author Jonathan Richardson from the University of Richmond in Virginia, expect more rats scurrying around. One more reason to floss. Flossing your teeth may help cut your stroke risk by more than 20%, a new study shows. Researchers tracked 6,258 adults over 25 years. They found that those who flossed at least once a week were 22% less likely to suffer an ischemic stroke, the most common type of stroke, and had a 44% reduced risk of the less common cardioembolic stroke. They were also 12% less likely to develop atrial fibrillation, which causes heart palpitations and can trigger strokes. These apparent benefits were independent of other aspects of oral hygiene, such as brushing teeth or visiting the dentist, and increased in line with how often people flossed. It's unclear what may be behind this link, but lead author Suvik Sen from the University of South Carolina says it's probably because bad oral health is associated with inflammation and artery hardening. Many people have expressed that dental care is costly, he tells the Times of the UK. Flossing is a healthy habit that is easy to adopt, affordable, and accessible everywhere. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.